DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum on DW, your one-stop shop for all the latest in science and technology. I'm Zulfi Karabani, and coming up, our creative streak makes a show as we look at the Art in Apps and the Art App Awards.
And sometimes they hit each other, so when they hit each other, they get red and they get a little bit more spiky, and then they get really angry because they always hit each other.
Also on the program, we get mindful and talk fanaticism and madness. And sit back, start a popcorn fight as we look back at 25 years of animation technology from Pixar Studios. All that and more right here on Spectrum. But first, the soaring popularity of smartphones and tablets has opened up a whole new world of possibilities for being creative, not just for artists, but also for everyday people. By using software applications installed on their phones, users can do everything from composing melodies and sketching paintings to penning poetry. Some art apps even go further than this, combining visuals, sounds and user interaction in fantastically innovative ways. Well, to focus attention on apps that foster creativity, Germany's Center for Media Art has started an annual award for the best advanced art apps, and the latest winners have just been announced. Kate Hairsine went along to the award ceremony in Karlsruhe.
This is the second year that Germany's prestigious Center for Art and Media has awarded three prizes worth €10,000 each to app developers. With more than 80 entries from 13 countries, the prize for art innovation went to Austrian media artist, poet and musician Jörg Pittinger. Pittinger won the award for his app called Consonant.
The app is a set of four sound games that work with language, with letters, with language sounds, letter shapes. I just show you the first one. You can draw lines.
Speaking after the ceremony, Pittinger uses his iPad to demonstrate how his app works, squiggling a grey line across the screen with his finger. At certain intervals, red dots appear on the line. When he lifts his finger off the screen, a letter N starts to flow down the line, humming every time it hits a dot.
You can then draw another line, and then will be the letter M. And sometimes they hit each other, so when they hit each other, they get red and they get a little bit more spiky, and then they get really angry because they always hit each other.
Another of the games in the app plays with the different sounds that the letter R makes in various languages. Pittinger says that his app combines his interest in voice, sound and visual poetry. Above all, what he loves about mobile apps, compared to programming for a normal PC, is the way in which they're interactive.
On these touch devices, you have all in one, so you can touch the letter, you can move the letter, you can directly manipulate all the sounds and also the letter form. So that was really fascinating for me to have this almost physical interaction with an imaginary object.
Der Sonderpreis Cloud Art geht an die App Electric Sheep.
A special award for cloud art went to the New York-based artist Scott Draves. Draves has developed an app called Electric Sheep, which uses complex mathematical algorithms to model the biological phenomena of evolution. The app creates a wallpaper made up of amazingly beautiful abstract images that swirl and spiral across the screen. The current 450,000 users of Electric Sheep can vote for the images that they find most beautiful.
In the app, let me actually get the interactive part up here, you get these little thumbs up and thumbs down things. If you like what you see, you push thumbs up, and that tells the network that you like that sheep. So every night, the most popular sheep in the flock mate with each other.
I was going to interrupt there. So when you say sure. The most popular sheep, so that the most popular mathematical equations that are producing these randomized visual patterns are then crossed with each other.
That's right. The images, they are the solution to an equation with thousands of parameters, and those parameters are like a genetic code. And so you can combine two of them. So the images can have sex, and there's a family resemblance. And so those are the ingredients for Darwinian evolution. But instead of survival of the fittest, It's a survival of the prettiest.
The equations to produce the visuals are so complex, though, that they can't be done on one computer alone. This is where cloud computing comes in.
The thousands of computers that have installed the software are working together as a supercomputer. Each one contributes just a little bit of work, and so they're combined by the server and then distributed, shared among all users. So it's really only possible to create this kind of art with an internet collaborative system.
The special prize for game art went to a group of German film students for their game Globusum Free. It might be somewhat surprising that an art museum is giving out international prizes for software. But the Centre for Art and Media's general manager, Christiana Riedel, says that art apps are underrated. The Apple Store, for example, sorts its 500,000 apps into categories such as travel or weather or sport. But there's no separate category for art.
We were wondering, where is the art in the exploding genre of apps? There is such a high creative potential and artistic potential in the new format of apps, so that we were looking and supporting the art genre for the apps.
Behind Christiana Riedel, people at the after party line up in a row at an exhibition stand, flipping and shaking tablets as they try out the apps from the competition. The best thing about attending this kind of art award is that if you like the art, you can actually afford to buy it. The most expensive app here costs €1.59. This is Kate Hairsine for DW in Karlsruhe.
Now, you know we like to be mindful here on Spectrum. Well, we're about to take a rather sharp turn into the worlds of extremism and madness. The mass murder case of Anders Breivik in Norway has shocked a lot, not least because of the act itself, in which Breivik admits to having killed 77 people in two virtually simultaneous attacks almost a year ago now, last July. But also because of the issue of his mental health. An early psychiatric assessment sparked a public outcry in Norway because it suggested that Breivik was insane. But according to some reports, at least, a majority of Norwegians think that Breivik is healthy enough to serve a prison sentence rather than be sent into psychiatric care. Breivik says being found insane would be a fate worse than death. Well, a verdict in the trial is expected by the end of August. But ahead of that, psychiatric experts are getting together at King's College London this week for the latest Maudsley debate to tackle the question of whether cases like Breivik's demonstrate that fanaticism is a form of madness. I spoke to Professor Tom Fahey, Professor of Forensic Psychiatry at King's College London and chair of the upcoming debate.
Some people hold such extreme beliefs that it's very difficult for the ordinary man on the street to understand how they arrived at that belief, and their belief or behaviour associated with the belief may appear irrational to the outside observer. When somebody appears to have irrational beliefs or behave in an irrational way, one reasonable conclusion is that they may be mentally ill, they may be delusional, or they may be acting under the influence of some mental abnormality.
The public reaction that you just alluded to there, we actually saw that, didn't we? In the case of Anders Breivik, the Norwegian public was quite convinced that he could go to a normal jail, and when the first psychiatric report suggested that he might be insane or mentally ill, there was an outcry against that, wasn't there?
Yes, I think when somebody has committed an extreme act, a very extreme act of violence, especially I think in a society like Norway, which is probably widely viewed as a very rational and sort of sensible country, I think it's an affront to the citizens. It's very difficult for them to understand the basis of that sort of behavior. The extremity of the homicidal rampage evokes almost a reflex reaction that the person must be mentally unwell, they must be insane.
But you don't have to be insane, do you, in order to commit insane acts, if I can put it that way?
Well, to commit very bad acts or very extreme acts, you don't need to be insane. You don't need to be mentally ill. In some instances, that sort of behavior in military campaigns or even within terrorist groups may be sanctioned, and maybe the views that an extremist may hold may be the same views as their peer group. When it comes to mental illness, we often distinguish delusional beliefs from extreme normal beliefs on the basis of whether or not those beliefs are shared by a peer group. if the person's beliefs appear to be irrational and they're not in any way reinforced by a peer group, for example, a religious group that they may be involved with or a political group, in those instances, we would veer towards the conclusion that the belief is a delusion.
And if we look again at the Anders Breivik case, the prosecution believes that it has not been properly established whether he is sane or insane. Anders Breivik has said that he is sane and
yeah.
He understands that the acts he committed were barbaric. I think that was one of the terms that he used.
Yeah.
Why is it so important that this should be thematicised, that this is an issue in a case such as this? I mean, are there ways to avoid the question of a person's, a suspect's mental condition?
I think in a homicide case, this issue inevitably emerges, was there mental illness or not? And in many jurisdictions, most people charged with a homicide will have a psychiatric evaluation before they appear in court. In the Breivik case, it's very important for two reasons. Breivik, of course, wants to establish that he is sane. He appears to be a highly narcissistic individual. I think the notion for him that his actions were motivated by some form of mental illness would invalidate his whole self-image, his whole identity, and call into purpose the rationality of his behavior. And he clearly thinks of himself as a very clever and rational individual. Now, from the prosecution point of view, if he is found guilty of murder under the criminal law, he receives a maximum finite jail sentence. If he's found insane, as in many jurisdictions, the length of time the person can spend in secure care is open-ended, and it's possible to detain somebody indefinitely as long as the authorities deem that the person poses a risk.
He has said himself that being put into mental health care would be worse than death. How do you see the final verdict coming out? What do you think might happen?
My own view is that this man clearly planned his murderous rampage very carefully. He was planning it, in fact, for several years, the evidence shows. He took very careful measures to avoid detection and avoid interruption during the rampage. He clearly knew that what he was doing was legally wrong. And I think under those circumstances, the idea that his disposal would be through mental health care rather than criminal justice route would be wrong. I think I'm not sure that mental health services would have much to offer either in terms of treatment. Having extreme racist or xenophobic ideas is not the province of psychiatry to address. You know, we don't treat people like that. There's no evidence that we can alter people's views. So in terms of managing any future risk, I think psychiatry would probably have a peripheral role.
Tom Fahey, Professor of Forensic Psychiatry at the Institute of Psychiatry in London, and he's also the chair of this week's Maudsley Debate at King's College London. You're listening to Spectrum with me, Zulfikar Abani, on DW. Online, we're at dw.de/spectrum, and you can, of course, follow us, if you like, at DW_SciTech.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Well, we hear a lot about social networks for all the all and sundry places where anyone and everyone can get together to share just about anything these days. But in Amsterdam, two young professionals have founded a very specific online network that connects young creative people at the start of their careers with organisations that need their expertise. And in the process, the founders have managed to carve out a little career for themselves, or a very big one indeed. Charlotte Lomas caught up with them for this profile.
My name is Nina Pearson and I'm from Amsterdam and I'm 26 years old.
My name is Annemarie van Gerwink. I'm from Amsterdam and I'm 24 years old. PUP is founded by Nina Pearson and me. We founded it in June 2011. My background, I studied international business and Nina studied journalism and communication.
The main thing what PUP is that we generate a platform for young creative talent in all different disciplines, so from a photographer to a poet, from a filmmaker to a caterer, with our main goal to give the PUPers exposure and to establish future work opportunities. the government cut a lot of fundings, especially in the cultural scene. So what happens now is that there are a lot of artists that don't get their fundings anymore. So then we started with the idea maybe we should generate this platform for them to expose their work. So that was like the first inspiration. There's this need, the necessity actually, for these young creatives to expose themselves in different ways. And then we thought, okay, we're going to arrange something where we bring two different worlds, the professional world and the young creative world, together. Clients, like and companies and commercial brands, they're looking for this easier, cheaper way to still be creative and cool and get to the target group that they want to reach. On the one hand, the clients need an innovative, cool way to still reach their target groups. And on the other hand, we provide work opportunities and, in a way, exposure to the young creatives.
So yes, we started as a foundation, a non-profit organization, but in the meanwhile, we also have a company, Pub Concepts, and we are working full-time on it. Then we have two interns, and then you have our Puppers.
So a Pupper is a young creative person with talent. It can be a photographer, it can be an artist, it can be a filmmaker, but also a writer, or an actor, or a poet.
That's almost 200 of them at the moment.
Our unique selling point, if you can call it like that, is that we have a big network around us. So we don't ask any Puppers for money to be with us. They can be with their own agency as well. See us as a platform. The only thing that we ask is bring your own network.
Yeah, that sharing those networks is a big value for Pup.
They get exposure. They connect with each other, so they generate new work with each other. We connect them to our clients, to the commercial brands. We try to sell their work in different ways, by arranging exhibitions. So there are all these different ways, actually. And we're not like an agency which we can hold their hand and every step of the way into their professional career. But we really generate this platform for them to get a bit closer to this big professional career. We always say we are like the bow and the Puppers are the arrow which we shoot into the professional world.
And thanks there to Charlotte Lomas for that. Well, millions of people around the world suffer from illnesses affecting the circulatory system. One of the main contributors is atherosclerosis, a narrowing or hardening of the arteries. Swiss and German researchers, however, say they've now developed a new nanotechnology for targeted treatment. Sonia Dean has more.
Imagine a fleet of tiny disc-shaped containers coursing through your blood, releasing medication at just the right location. That's the concept behind a study by doctors, chemists, and physicists at the universities of Geneva and Basel, published in the journal Nature Nanotechnology. The medication targets areas in arteries, that is, the vessels that carry blood away from your heart, that have narrowed due to a buildup of fatty deposits. This condition is called atherosclerosis, and it becomes prevalent as people age. Atherosclerosis is a factor in potentially fatal circulatory conditions such as angina, stroke, or heart attack. Dr. Bert Müller, a physicist from Berlin who contributed to the study, explains how the nanocontainers work.
The nanocontainers are injected into the blood vessel system and they travel through the normal tissues, that means the healthy arteries and veins, without any interaction. But at the stenosed vessels, that means at the narrowing of the vessels where the blood flow is increased, they open and release their content.
This application is based on a principle called shear stress, that when liquid flows through a tubular shape, velocity is faster at the center than at the edges. So the increased pressure of blood flowing through narrowed arteries actually triggers the nanocontainers to release their load. Dr. Müller, again.
Our nanocontainers have a lenticular shape, so they are not like the typical ones in a spherical shape, but they have something like an equator, and along that equator, the arrangement of the molecules is less stable, the molecules are less ordered, and therefore at these positions, the drug is believed to be released.
Alberico Catapano, a Milan-based clinical pharmacologist and president of the European Atherosclerosis Society, is intrigued by the concept.
Theoretically, it's very, very interesting, and is one of the ways people can think about delivering drugs in the area where a coronary plaque is present.
The treatment of atherosclerosis often involves pharmaceutical drugs, But these drugs can have side effects.
Pharmacological treatments are treatments that are linked to reducing effectively blood pressure, to reducing effectively glycemia and keeping that under control for diabetes, and especially to control lipids, in particular cholesterol. Every drug does have a pattern of adverse events that are related to the drug.
The new lentil-shaped nanocontainers are too tiny to see, at about 100 to 200 nanometers wide. Organic chemists from the Geneva team made them out of diaminophospholipids, a material similar to that of human cell membranes, but with an unstable molecular structure that enables the targeted release of drugs. This targeted release could help patients avoid certain side effects. Dr. Bert Müller of the Swiss research team.
If we go it in a systemic way, that means all the blood vessels will widen, then the blood pressure drops down. But having just the targeted release at the stenosed vessels, that means at the narrowed vessels, we can avoid the undesired side effects.
However, Katapano of the Atherosclerosis Society says the idea of targeted medication delivery isn't new.
This has been a concept that has been around for a long time for tumors. You know, people is looking for those dream bullets. Pharmacological bullets. No one has really succeeded in that yet, so I think we are not so close to this. But that will be the end goal of all therapies, to just to bring the drug where it's needed. This may be one step forward, but we have to wait and see the results that will come out from further research.
In some sense, atherosclerosis is an inevitable part of aging. But, as Katapano reminds, it can also be prevented.
All in all, the best way to prevent atherosclerosis or try to delay it is to have appropriate lifestyle. So that means eating a prudent diet, eat moderate amount of the fat food that is solid at room temperature, like butter or cheese and so on, and then have a good exercise, practicing sports, especially aerobic sports. Like, you know, running with a moderate pace or doing cross-country skiing or skiing, any exercise will do it.
Next, the team in Basel and Geneva will focus on what kind of molecule to use for the structure of the nanocontainers. They could take an existing material or develop a new one that would require new regulatory approval. It could be years before the disc-shaped nanocontainers can be used in practice. So in the meantime, keep watching your cholesterol.
Sonia Dean with that report. And now to something a little more light-hearted, the world of animated film. Over the past 25 years, Pixar Studios in California have been credited with revolutionising the world of movie animation with their children's films like Toy Story, Finding Nemo and Cars. And it's not just the kids who love talking toys, adults love them too. After all, adults make the films and they like to make the films that they like to watch. But as Jesse Wingard has been finding out, we wouldn't have the films if it weren't for the technology.
What are you going to do with these old toys?
Okay, calm down, guys. Let's just keep this in perspective.
Where is she taking us?
I should have seen this coming.
We'll be fine, Jesse.
Oh, I hate all this uncertainty!
The lights have dimmed, the curtains open. You catch a whiff of freshly popped corn coming from the back of the movie theatre. Imagine the sounds you're hearing are the beginnings of the next blockbuster animated film you're about to see on the big screen before you.
Barbie.
Love your leg warmers.
Nice ascot.
Oh, I want to get played with.
Cinematic film is more than a century old, but the basic techniques used, for early silent cartoons such as Felix the Cat to animated Walt Disney classics like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, haven't really changed in that time. Filmmaking begins with ideas, drawings and scripts. But what happens when a small US-based company decides to go beyond what audiences have come to know and love?
You've got a friend in me. You've got a friend in me.
25 years ago, Pixar Studios created a short film in California. A simple pencil sketch of a bumblebee and a lovable character called Andre. 8 years later, kids the world over were blown away with the first entirely computer-generated feature-length film, Toy Story, starring Buzz, Woody, and their toy friends running amok in Andy's bedroom.
We're busting out of here.
Okay, all clear.
We gotta get you home before Andy leaves tomorrow.
And what's important now is we stay together.
I was 10 at the time. I remember the film's great palette of colours, the catchy soundtrack. But most of all, it was the realisation that the images I was watching didn't just happen in my dreams or my imagination. They happened on the screen. It was real, somehow. Seeing the toys come to life in the cinema was more than just great entertainment. To a child, it can be magic.
The great thing about animation is you get to create worlds. You don't have to go to the worlds that exist, which are fascinating, but you get to make completely new worlds up.
That's Elise Kladman, director of Pixar University Archives in the United States. The studio says it aims to expand the imaginations of the young and the young at heart through animated film. The now grown-up me is forever being drawn back to the animated medium because it allows me to revisit my childhood. Kim Donovan is Exhibitions Manager for Pixar Studios.
The thing about Pixar is that they make films that they want to watch, and so there's an adult element to it, but there's also kind of an ageless element to them as well, right? If the story's good enough, then it surpasses any age levels and just becomes a universal experience.
Before computer-generated imaging, or CGI, animators used to draw hundreds of pictures, altering each slightly from the last, photographing them and playing them back in quick succession so it looked like the pictures were moving. Ever since Pixar's first three-minute test film in 1987, the technology has changed dramatically. Elise Kladman again.
What it's done is pushed people's imaginations to possibilities, and lots of other wonderful, talented, brilliant people are developing other technology and other ideas and different ways of making films.
Elise says the introduction of high-speed computing software, where characters can be created entirely on a network of computers, has helped with that process immensely. But still, animators today are choosing to stick with traditional forms of storyboard generation.
Once there's some ideas that are clear enough, like the character is going to be, you know, a monster, then the artists can start coming up with visual ideas and drawing all kinds of possibilities, both for the characters and for the worlds, and for the look of the film. As soon as they've got a little bit of sense of that, they're also talking about what is the technology that's going to be needed for this film. Is it something like Nemo, where they're going to clearly need to develop water and how that works? So the technical people also start doing research and development. In the first 2 years of the film, that's a lot of what's going on. Then it goes into the digital realm, and you start to build the models in the computer, to build the sets, to figure out how you're going to place the camera, to create the textures, to create the lighting. It takes about 4 years to make one of our films.
So, does all this technology really play a part in the cinematic experience, or are people watching animated films purely for their storylines?
Well, it does play a role in the sense that you think it's amazing what you can do with technology, right? But I think, you know, what I really find most convincing and endearing is the characters that you have. The characters that are brought alive with this technology, outdo anything else.
Whether it's the characters or the technology that creates the magic, it's hard to draw the line. All I know is I'm a fan. Jesse Wingard, DW, Bonn. You've got a friend in me.
You've got a friend in me. There you go. Our eternally childlike Jesse Wingard there. Thank you very much. Well, that's just about all from Spectrum on DW for now. Don't forget, you can always keep up with our stuff at dw.de/science. Listen again or download the podcast at dw.de/spectrum. Up soon on Spectrum, the fossils of copulating turtles. Hope you can make it then. I'm Zulfikar Abani. Our studio tech was Gert Gyorgy. Thanks for listening and bye for now. Tomorrow you'll cook dinner for the neighbors and the kids. We can rip apart those socialists and all their damn taxes. The CIA, no criminal. I'm down on both bad knees. I'm just too much.